Okay, so when we left you yesterday, I had convinced myself and maybe some of you that it was plausible that Rashi was opposed to any serious contemplation of art whatsoever. I mentioned this to at Beit Din today, and Rabbi Helfinger said, "Did they believe you?" Rashi was really against art. I said, "Yeah, I'm not so sure it's wrong," but he didn't think it was so plausible. So I'm wondering how many of you at this point believe that it's plausible that Rashi actually bans all serious contemplation of art, which means at least those of you who were into the scene on our trip should, plausible, meaning that if someone asks you, Miriam Jaffe, what are the odds that Rashi really believed that all contemplation of visual art was usur? He would say, not less than 25%. She's thinking, 24.9, 24.91, 24.9.
I would say it's plausible.
It's plausible. What about you, Jared?
Plausible.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I don't know how else. I mean, I'm just reading it over right now. I don't know other ways to read it, unlike what we said before.
Okay, good. Miriam, do you have a verdict here?
Not necessarily plausible or not plausible.
All right. What about you, Emily? What do you think? Not plausible? Right? You're not. You don't buy it yet. Okay.
More Rashi, so that we can check
this again? Lots of Rashi, you can check it again. I don't know. So now, Yedidia, if you say you don't find it plausible, is that the...
plausible.
You said it is plausible.
Yeah.
Is there any chance that Rashi holding this would change your personal practice?
A plausible chance? Very, very low chance.
Very, very low chance. Aha. What about you, Jared? Suppose we come out, right, really firmly convinced that Rashi held that, would you then decide?
I don't look at Rashi as a halachic seifer. So until I see it in a halachic work, until it's brought to halacha, I don't see a reason that it should bind me halachically.
I see. Okay, that's an interesting thing. So Rashi...
What would the word art mean to Rashi?
Pardon?
What would the word art mean?
A visual, well, as of now, it means
a
visual.
Anything in which the form is of the primary.
Yeah, I might say anything it's the form. Right. We could do that. Anything, something humanly produced for visual interest. A religion might be asked according to Rashi to look at a parochet. No. Let's say they aren't Kodesh in the shul. They aren't Kodesh in the shul.
Yeah, it has tov on it.
Primarily to
that's totally Sharon Hediotol.
Yeah, I'm certainly not, to read. We should all be aware, right? You should all be like, obviously, all these things, right, have to be ignored on Shabbos.
Why?
It's
Sharon Hediotol. Why?
Because you
do
need to
do that. And who allows them during the week? I mean, that's foolishness.
It might be Psukim or Mutter. So it's an interesting question, right? So what if instead of saying, this is the Milchama of David and Goliath, you just quoted the Pasuk? Would that be usher to read it on Shabbos? If you have underneath a picture, it just gives you the Pasuk. Let's say my
I think my menorah actually has a Psukim.
My favorite Haggadah of Yossi Rosenstein is, it gives you Psukim and Midrashim as the captions for the paintings. So should they be Esther? Maybe there's an exception for Torah. Maybe there's an exception for Torah. Yehuda, what do you want to say?
Well, we were just talking about Kitei Kodesh. That was a big issue.
Mm-hmm.
So they might just as easily be Esther to me, but they're not.
Well, we get rid of that. That we'll see. Everybody gets rid of the Esther on Ketuvim on the grounds that people don't really spend all day going to the Shir anymore.
So what does it matter whether they're Psukim or not? They're captions.
So they're captions. So they should be Esther. All right. There's a lot of stuff that Rashi could ban. I was talking about the Beit Din Sederot, the Helfinger. I just said, yeah.
Did Rabbi Helfinger give an alternative read? And if so, I would be interested.
No, he didn't have the Rashi in his head. I just said on the way down the elevator, I think I convinced all my students yesterday that Rashi bans all looking at art. And he said something like, did they take you seriously? which is interesting. So one question is this the reductio ad absurdum? Right? Is it impossible that Rashi would have said something like that? You don't think it's impossible?
I disagree.
Why would it be?
Why would it be? Why do you think it's impossible, Rachel?
I think it's impossible. The Jewish sort of artifact throughout the ages and the structure of things and the elaborateness of synagogues throughout Jewish history, even Chutz La'aretz, I think that we have as much evidence as possible to show that art, particularly like Jewish art, has been very much condoned in a positive way, has been allowed by all, has been allowed by Poskim, and I think that for Rashi to truly believe there should be no art, I find that so hard to believe. It's very possible for me to believe that he's saying it just because art was defined in his time as Christian art, but I cannot see him in the 21st century ever saying, oh, all art, that's what I meant.
So you can't...
Is Rashi saying that this is halakha, or is he explaining the Gemara, which may or may not be halakha?
Well, you could get out of it by claiming we don't paskin like this Gemara, but that would be a chiddush to claim that we paskin against this Gemara. I don't know, you'd have to find a conflicting sugya. Yes, Jonathan?
The historical claim is faulty. I mean, we know from Eliakim, right, that there are at least significant communities at that point where the minhag was not to have any art in shul, right? If shul is the proof, right, you can't assume that post-Rashi,
We don't know. We don't have the Rabbi Eliakim banning geometric squares.
Okay,
right.
Fine. But I'm saying
Okay, so it's an interesting question about how you set up Rosenzweig's phrase as the parameters of the plausible. All right, and we talked about this last night. Right, so what Pshat and Rashi is depends on, among other things, on what your presumptions are of what Rashi could have said.
Anything, what it seems like from or it seems historically from the sources, is that there was sort of always some kind of push by the general population, always some kind of resistance by the, like in some capacity or other, depending on what the concern was, change. There was always some kind of resistance.
My issue is more the notion whether it's really plausible that Rashi, because it's not art, right? This is part of what Rachel was getting at. It's not art that Rashi bans. It's the sustained visual contemplation of human production.
Well, does Rashi use the word sustained visual contemplation?
No, astonishingly enough, because he wrote in Hebrew. The question is, the question is whether that is a viable translation of L'histakel. All right, so I am translating L'histakel as sustained visual contemplation. All right, yes, Rachel.
I just think it's also like important to remember, for us to remember that at his time, as far as I know, the definition of art, the norm of art, was so radically different from how we define it now. He was living in an actively Christian country that was.
And we're not.
What?
We should ban advertising.
Agreed, but I'm saying that basically all good art, high class art of that time.
But he's not banning banning high class art. If my read is right, he's banning everything. He's banning looking at Coke bottles and saying nice shape. I mean,
he has one example. I mean,
yeah.
This Rashi on the second page that we did yesterday.
Yep.
So he has two examples.
Mm-hmm.
Which are really part of one example of things drawn on walls, and he has one root of thing that he mentions, but what else falls into the category of those examples and comes from that root could be expanded or contracted, and I mean we have no way of assuming how broad or not broad it is, and it seems like that's the question, and that's just ambiguous in Rashi, and we can guess based on that time period, but I don't know that that's a good way of figuring out what he meant by saying, well, what would he have meant based on his time period? Just saying that this is what he says, and then he is silent everywhere else, and we don't know.
Excellent. So you wish to unpreempt Jonathan, or to preempt Jonathan's what? Preemption. Yesterday Jonathan said, don't say it means only the examples in Rashi. So you're saying, don't say it means only, right? Don't say it means everything, right? Maybe it means only the examples in Rashi.
No,
we have a whole area.
The examples are examples. It could mean other things. What those other things are, I don't know, but I don't necessarily think that looking at history, especially without looking it up and just trying to figure out what history would have been, probably isn't the best way of going out figuring out.
Okay, so Rachel raises a broad methodological question, which is the whole issue of how you deal with post-Kim, or even commentators, always address their reality. So you can never know, right, you can never transfer it precisely, right? You just sort of have to guess about what would they say if circumstances change. What would they say about new circumstances? Would they say fire, electricity is fire? Would they not? Would they say that brain death is death? Right? All these sorts of things, you just, right, you don't know. They can only talk about the things that they talked about. We don't know more than that. Yes, Rachel.
Also, just, I mean, last night you were talking about, you know, Midrash, and sort of that we have to read generously because it makes no sense for us to say that, you know, basically an entire area of our tradition is based on, you know, a bunch of rabbis with false premises. That doesn't really make sense, and it's not, you know, a viable option for a whole area of our...
You don't want Rashi to say something which strikes you as totally out of sympathy with the human condition.
Exactly, with the human condition at large, but also it's so sweepingly making everything up there. If it's really that you can't even look or appreciate a Coke bottle, I feel like that's saying, you know, you basically can't live in the world. You basically can't function like any normal human being day to day. And that's impossible.
Okay.
I don't think Rashi's that insensitive.
Good, so that's a, right, that's a fair question, right?
They probably didn't have writing kind of Coke bottles in Rashi.
But they were human beings. Human beings look at things and find them interesting.
You imagine the world of like Avi Shmidman, where you post Prakam of Tanakh on the back of all the cereal boxes, so that's what your kids read instead.
But the cereal box has a shape.
Right. It's perfect shape for to put words.
No, and there's no visual interest, right? You know, God forbid you should start thinking about the font. Hard to imagine.
You do it in Ashurah.
You do it in what?
You do it right in Tavashur.
You do it in Tavashur. The world is... there is a...
Well,
nature's fine.
Well,
Rashi doesn't mind nature.
You
should imagine the world. There is a character in a Philip K. Dick novel.
To what extent do we feel like this is right, if we read it this way, like, to what extent do we feel like this is poskening Musar?
I don't know. I was going to say, I have to get into shtick. There's a Philip K. Dick novel, which begins with the great line, I forget that the character is, was going sane. And the way he goes sane is he starts seeing that they're... going sane. That's why it's a great line.
Novels are weird.
I'm so confused.
Somebody was going sane. And the way he goes sane is that he stops seeing objects, and all he sees are pieces of paper with the name of the object written on them. Now, why is that? Because, in fact, there has been a nuclear war. And there aren't, right, and everything that he ever knew has been destroyed. But in his head, he has the secret to the, right, to the weapon they can have to still win the war. But he, right, but he can only think about it if he's reasonably calm. So they hypnotize him into believing that everything that he cares about is still there. They hypnotize him into believing that that when he sees a piece of paper which says wife, he sees his wife, but he sees a piece of paper that says, right, that says house. He sees his house. But then he slowly goes sane. Right? He slowly starts seeing that it's really just pieces of paper, and not things. This is the world we want to live in, according to Rashi, right? In which we right? No, there's nothing there. Nobody ever has any visual interest at all. If you look at a door and you say door, right? And you ignore the fact that the door has panels.
The only visual interest is in right God's world.
Yeah, the only vision, right? Only vision. So that's interesting. If Rashi's really that extreme, and now this is, Miriam points out correctly, right, the conflicting attempts at preemption are interesting. Miriam points out correctly that Rashi doesn't tell you. All he tells you is that the reason for the prohibition is not to turn to things which you are making midat levavchem v'chalal shalachem. And that leaves open the opportunity for an exclusion if we can construct a category of humanly produced objects which are not mechalal midat levachem v'chalal shelachem.
Like things that you make while you're sleeping.
Like things you make while you're sleeping, because then you're full.
Or food.
No, because then it's not midat levachem.
Yes, you did.
Well, me and Yedidia were talking about yesterday could mean things that, images that enhance your without Hashem. Like you see a nice landscape and you think, wow, it's a great example.
Images that enhance your without Hashem. Why aren't they midat levavchem v'chalal shelachem?
So the example we thought of was puting.
Yeah.
Right, so... Right? One could make the argument that, right, piyut in shul, right, is asher asim midat levachem v'chalal shelachem. But I'm willing to go, right, the Rachel route and say, it is not to me conceivable that Rashi would have possibly considered asering piyut in shul. Therefore, there must be something that's humanly produced that's not considered, right?
Uh-huh. Do you want to point out, really what I'm pointing out is, why does Rashi limit us to the visual? Why does Gemara limit us to the visual according to Rashi?
Right.
Why is poetry mutter?
I mean, not all poetry is necessarily mutter.
Music.
You have to start saying that you are intuitively sure must be mutter, and I'm intuitively sure that piyut
Interesting. Okay, what's the...
You can work from there.
So Miriam gave us one exegetical way out, which he is working with. The exegetical way out is to claim that means dat levachem v'chalal shelachem is a definition which can be narrowed to exclude certain human products. Okay, what's the other exegetical way out? You want to take me seriously yesterday? That's the other way in which you can create a category in Rashi that's mutter. Thank you. We can say that obviously only Dukna Odar Asur and Tsurudar Mutar.
Right, but then if it's because of this general reason, then everything else would at least be looked down on.
Now we know, now we have to figure out what's the difference between a Tsura and a Dukin. So what is a Tsura? A Tsura is a picture of Chayot Mishunot. And a Dukin is a picture of the Melchemet David Vigoliath. So we talked about maybe the difference between animals and human beings, but that seems very hard to justify in terms of Rashi's rationale. But what we talked about the difference between fiction and reality, so you objected that the Muhammad David and Goliath really happened. But I have no idea what the Muhammad David and Goliath looked like. But I can know what Chayot looked like. I can paint them from life. So maybe Rashi bans imaginative art, and we could talk about imaginative art about the real world. Maybe he bans all imaginative art, and maybe he bans all art which replaces what actually happened with your imagination. Right, so that would be a much narrower category. Right? It's specifically things like the Milchemet David and Goliath, where you are inventing what Tanakh looks like. That is prohibited. That I think is about the narrowest read I can get of Rashi, because as all of you should immediately point out, right? How is Milchemet David and Goliath is not a product of human imagination? It's only the visualization of Milchemet David and Goliath is a product of human imagination. Still, right? So I would not be so happy banning imagination per se. So I would be happiest if we could limit this to some claim about the concretization, it's sort of an anti-visual midrash. Right? Which might be the easiest way of framing it. That Rashi is opposed to visual midrash. Right? If you take one of the definitions of midrash I offered last night, which is that midrash concretizes an interpretation into a specific, even though it's not committed to that specific. Right, so by the same token, right, so... Because that's what the Gemara says. Right, Gemara says, right, it says that's really stakel. So I don't have any basis for extending that to any other form, to non-visual contemplation. So I think the narrowest way of reading that Rashi thinks that things that... He objects to the painting of historical scenes because they're false. They're the replacement of what happened with your imagination of what happened. I think that's the narrowest I can get it. Yes, Yehuda.
Well, what I thought immediately and still might have some meaning is that it was just Rashi is banning the kind of thing which is where Jeno wins the battle and he brags about how great he is and makes himself a little statue, which is insulting to Hashem. You can understand why he's saying, look at my great thing I did.
Okay, but his example, he has to ban Milchamet David the Goliath on a wall.
Right, of course. That's the primary example. Right, because...
That's not a general. That's
no, that's the best example, because that's the example in Tanakh where Hashem was most involved. So if you view it now, it's really a big deal. It's really, David could not have defeated Goliath under any situation.
Right, David is not making the poster, right? It's people in Rashi's time.
I know, you're just making a poster of David and Goliath. You're glorifying David when it wasn't about David at all.
What if I make a poster of David and Goliath, which shows this puny little kid swinging a tiny rock and a divine hand guiding it towards Goliath.
Whoa. Divine hand?
You're a painter. You can find some way to do a divine hand without drawing it as a hand if you think you object to drawing God as a hand.
So then maybe that's not what he's talking about.
I know. He doesn't tell me anything about what kind of...
He says, Adam shall ma'asim could go in Milchamet David and Goliath. So it seems to be saying, like, it's something about, like, human, right?
It works for you. Not gonna.
It's more plausible than
mine. It's more plausible than mine.
Sorry, I just heard from you.
Uh-huh. Could be. I'm not so sure how happy I am with... I mean, the advantage of it is, for me, is that the problem I have with all the Yisurim Avodah Zarah is that we ban the painting, if there are anything like that, but I don't think, and you can tell me, I don't think that the purpose is to prevent you from visualizing. Right? Like, when you read the Milchama of David and Goliath, are you not supposed to imagine David? Are you not supposed to ever to think about what angels look like? If you were never supposed to think what angels look like, why is Yechezkel describing them for you?
You're not supposed to learn that.
You're not supposed to learn that, Terry. Okay, Yeshaya, if you want. So it seems to me that if there is any meaning to those Yisurim, the meaning has to be that we distinguish between the imagination and the concretization of the imagination. Now you might ask, so why don't we ban writing it down too? And it's an interesting question to me whether really Lo Ta'asu Niti should ban verbal descriptions of everything that it bans visual descriptions of. Or for that matter, right, if instead of Flight of the Bumblebee, whoever it was had composed Flight of the Cherub, then maybe we should ban that too on Lugazu Lo Ta'asu Niti. Because what's he doing imagining what a cherub is like? Maybe music is more ethereal and doesn't count as concretization, because everybody will listen to it and think something different anyway.
Maybe the point is that you're not allowed to mention it.
So maybe the prohibition, really it says Lo Tassun, really the prohibition is, the prohibition Al Tifnu is really a version of Lo Tassun. I mean, really, you have to spend your entire time fighting against imagination when you're reading Tanakh.
It's just a mantra. Just saying the words improves your soul.
No, but you can not visualize. You can just think of David. David is an abstraction, and he has the characteristics mentioned. Now, David actually has a visual description, but the visual description will be kind of fuzzy. David's kind of a Rothko. He has a color in him somewhere. Red. But you don't make your decision about whether it's red hair or ruddy, because that would require too much imagination. You just know that David is sort of suffused with red. It could be. And it may be the reason I don't like that is because of Miracle on 34th Street. Which, the point is that the mother is opposed to imagination. There are many, many fantasy books that are about parents who are opposed to imagination. But I'm happiest if we carve out a claim that prohibitions against visualizations are specifically about concretizations of imagination. And there are areas where you're not supposed to attribute that much claim. That I could deal with Rashi saying. I'm not sure I'm convinced historically that Rashi couldn't say that. Rishonim sometimes say the darndest things. I don't know what Rashi's world is like. I can't say. Professor Carmi used to say that it was clear that Rashi was an intellectual because he wrote mediocre poetry. And people who write great poetry might just be poets, and people who write bad poetry might have a deep misapprehension of their ability. So people who write mediocre poetry are people who clearly think writing poetry is important. That's the only reason you would do it. So maybe if you take that Rashi was an intellectual, so iconoclastic intellectuals of that sort are a little bit odd. But I don't know. I don't know. One way to check it methodologically is to see Rashi rarely has a position which goes nowhere. Right? Usually Rashi has so much influence that almost everything Rashi says has a life after him, because it's so hard to read Gemara without him afterwards, and almost everybody takes it in. So it's worth trying to look around and see if there any other Rishonim say anything like this. Right? What is it, right? How do other people interpret his words? Then after we do that, then we can go back and take a look and think of what we think was plausible in Rashi. Then we also have to take up Jared's question about whether we take Rashi as having halachic weight or not. And maybe we don't care. Right? If Rashi says this, we just say, so what? Yes?
I feel like a lot of this probably has to do, right, we're trying to like envision to ourselves like what makes somebody say something like this. Like we have to try to think of like the closest analogs that like we intuitively identify with, like kids playing video games. Instead of like, you know, what is this foolishness? You know, this isn't real. This is just like, you know, and like we wouldn't dream about saying about books, but it doesn't occur to us that this is inconsistent. Or right, there's like, and then we try, and then we know what it is we don't like because we disapprove of it, and it's like conventional to disapprove of it. But then we try to figure out, right? It starts getting weird and inconsistent. We try to figure out what it is that we actually disapprove about the thing. And it could be that, right? Rashi just had kids who, right, who would look at the, you know, whatever it is, and he thought that it was foolish, and he was just, you know, sort of resented the, you know, the, right?
So this is true that people sometimes say inconsistent things. One of the rabbis in my sister's neighborhood at one point gave a shiur on women learning Gemara, in which he said that women, you know, it's obviously usher for women to learn Gemara, except those Gemaras which are necessary for them to know Halacha. And he sounded really frum, and a brother-in-law went over to him and asked him, and said, don't you believe that all of Gemara is interconnected? Is it really possible to understand Halacha without knowing all of Shas? And he said, of course not. So then what's usher for women to learn? Nothing. there are positions, but yet he probably believed that he could sustain a plausible, right, a plausible distinction between those Gemaras that are essential to Masa, and not while simultaneously maintaining that, of course, the Posek has to know everything, and if somebody walks out and says, I want to be the Gadol HaDor, I'm just never going to touch Zvachim. They're going to say, how can you not touch Zvachim, right? Like, you know, you're going to do Gittin, and you're going to discuss the issue of Lishma, and not talk about Stam and Lishma by Zvachim, you know, right? You know, as soon as you walk in, you're out of the picture. So maybe, it may be that Rashi was... Rashi believed that he could make a distinction between things that were merely midat levavchem, nechalal shalachem, and things that somehow had a spark of God in them. And he believed that video games were clearly us there because those are purely human creations that have no substance to them at all, whereas Tolstoy, Nash, right, things like that, they clearly had. There's no havamid about Star Trek. Star Trek was obviously mutter all the way. But, yeah, that's only because Rashi watched it, so we know that.
John Locke has this treatise on, like, how to educate kids.
Uh-huh.
And he, at one point, he goes in this tirade about fruit, about how, like, all kids want all the time is fruit. And it's bad for them. You shouldn't let them have too much fruit. And it's just, you can hear, right, you can hear just replace it with candy. Every time he says fruit, you replace it with candy, it could have been written today. But now everybody's, like, falling into this, trying to get their kids to eat fruit, right? So it's just sort of like, you know, every time has this, you know, thing, has its own thing that people want to do that you don't want them to be doing in, like, yeah.
Uh-huh. Sure. Okay. I think that's very interesting. All right. Good. Alright, so let's move on to Tosfot for now. So, Ora, how did you understand the first Tosfot?
I
So the question was, if Gemara was talking about the Benan Shel Shoshim that didn't look at the, whatever, we don't know exactly what it was.
Yeah.
And, you know, the question is, like, why is that a big deal? It's a
softer
to look at. So therefore,
you know. Okay, good. So now, what does Tosfos assume a duke in it?
if we can raise a condition, a contradiction between Benanshul Kedoshim and this Gemara, then if you can, what's on the coin?
A
faith, human faith. So the Dukin has to include...
Historical. Would it have to be, like, historical?
I don't know. So the Dukin presumably has to include a relief, right? A raised relief of human faith. Yes, Yuna?
Interesting point is, I think, I don't know for sure, but I think probably a lot of ancient coins have the name of the king on them.
So it has a caption, too. So we shouldn't... don't look at them on Shabbos. That's
no,
okay.
No, I'm saying it's interesting. I don't know if that's exclusive, but it has to have caption. Not be. Only
called
Dukin
captions. Probably. Only called Dukin. That's hard.
I don't know. I'm just saying.
Interesting. I don't know. I don't think so, but if it turned out to be true, it would be really interesting. Okay. So now, what's Sosa's answer?
It's, like, only things that you commonly see, you don't have to be
mapping for. Does that make any sense to you at all? No. Right? This is one of the wildest answers you can imagine. Oh, things you always look at. Right? You don't have to worry about looking at. So, is there any way that you can salvage it?
Well, because it's not Hafnah.
It's not Hafnah. Yeah? Now tell me what Hafnah is.
Well,
so I can know what it's not.
Well, because Hafnah is sort of turning to look at something, and possibly also that it can cause some other bad thing, either thoughts or idol worship or whatever it may be. And but it's something that you look at all the time. It's not that you're turning to see it, and it's not like it's going to have any impact on you because it's just something that is always in your field of vision.
So the solution to the Avodah Zarah visual problem is to put symbols of Avodah Zarah everywhere, and then nobody will be tempted by them at all. Let's surround ourselves by every Beit Midrash.
Well, either
actually, I'm not going to tell the
story. Yes.
So either we would say that only applies to things that are not Avodah Zarah, or we could say that, yeah, you're right.
All right. Yeah, all right. Interesting decorative scheme for our Beit Midrash. Okay, did you want the story you wanted
no,
to tell?
No, I'm not
going to.
All
right, what do you want to say?
I think it's just a rephrasing of Abaye is called a Mishkechei Pasek.
Abaye is?
Called a Mishkechei Pasek.
Called a Mishkechei, yeah.
It's just saying, it's ridiculous. We can't ban everything. You have to use money. So you see it too often to avoid.
Uh-huh. You see it too often. You want to take Tosis away from an argument that there is no psychological impact to a practical argument.
Yeah.
Things that you have to look at, Tadir, as opposed to things that you do look at, Tadir.
You can't use coins.
It would be nice if Tosis said... If Tosis...
EFSHAR or something like
that. EFSHAR. It would be nice.
Otherwise, I can't see how you can formulate into saying something that makes sense.
I agree. It's a challenge to formulate into something that makes sense. Yes, Tadir.
The other thing you could say is you could go to the definition of Hafnah as something that's sustained and contemplative.
Yeah.
And if that's the case, then because money is just sort of an object we have all over the place, that's not the general way we interact with it.
Okay, that's possible. There's a debate in tradition some years back between Rav Henkin and I forget who wrote the response to Rav Henkin, possibly Rav Feldman, on the topic of habituation. Right, so Rav Henkin took the position that exposure to certain things that might have been considered erotic stimuli in the time of the Gemara are no longer usur, because if you live in a world of underwear advertisements, then it's kind of silly to claim that it's usur to look at fingernails. So it might be right. So nobody, it doesn't mean it's ideal. It doesn't mean that that you should spend your time staring at fingernails, but it also means that it's not usur, right? So if there's a good reason, you have to walk down the street, right? You have to engage in commerce. So there's a good reason, right? There's a good reason. So we're not going to ban having a coin around because of the risk that all of a sudden you will decide to regard this coin as a work of great visual interest. You might, but it's not so likely, right? You can't live in a world that, right? If we could prevent you from ever seeing faces on coins, that would be great. But in practice, no matter how much we ban it, people will still see them. So by the time you're 15 already, you'll have seen so many of these that it's silly.
Would this exclude sort of the
anniversary coins or certain things where it'll have a different image on it for like a week. They'll print one coin and then they won't again.
Ah, so that's an interesting question. Does it have to be the specific image so that you are, right? Because what happens if you move to a new country and the coinage is utterly new? So it should be up there to look at any of the coins in the new country, at least until you've been sufficiently habituated, you've looked at enough of them, and often enough accidentally. Or does Tosis mean there's a class, right? Nobody, right, it's a version of the Kelim Mivuzim, Kelim Mechubadim argument, which is that nobody treats coins.
Rare coins, people collect them.
So that's an interesting question. Maybe it's faster to look at rare coins when I list regular coins. What about bills? Right? What happens if we had a contest, great artist contest to put their image on bills? We'll have the capacity soon to put little corners on bills, right? Where there'll be a special issue like stamps, right? Stamps now are commissioned works of art. So the first time you see a stamp, you might contemplate it, right? If it's an image, right? You might even take a microscope into it and look and see if there's a Mug and Dovid hidden in Dr. Revel's beard, which apparently there is, in the Dr. Revel stamp. Apparently there's a Mug and Dovid hidden in the beard. So you might take a look at it with great interest. There are all sorts of other things hidden in other people's beards which they didn't notice beforehand. Obviously, this stands in pretty stark contrast, if not contradiction, to the Sefer Chassidim, which thinks that you can't have windows that way because that will habituate you. Right? So here he says that once it's not, Yeah, so let's say it's a contrast, not a contradiction. Because you can hardly have chila, right? He's just saying, in practice, you can try all you want, but there's no possibility that people will not have seen faces on coins. Everyone will be habituated to it. Just as, you can, right, short of blinking your eyes, right, there isn't any possibility that people will not have seen exposed parts of bodies of the person of the other gender in photographs nowadays. Right. Like it or not, right? Even if you ban television and the internet, and you only live in Borough Park, they will still be bus shelters. You can burn down the bus shelters, there'll still be other stuff. Right? It's just not possible. Pardon?
That's what Islam does.
People try.
Yes.
People try, but it doesn't work. It just doesn't. Right? It just doesn't work unless you have a pardon?
It also ends up with a horrible culture. You affect half people because you have to prevent that.
I'm not talking about men versus women necessarily, right? Because the other way around, it's just
you have to affect one person to make sure they're never seen.
Well, so I don't want to get into the men versus women issue.
Well,
that's
you just have everyone in society agreeing with you.
Yeah, if in a homogeneous society, you can pull things off.
In the north side of the city, and women in the south.
Right, but if you have a heterogeneous society, it's not gonna. Right, it's really not gonna work. Does he claim?
True.
Could be.
I think that's just modern society.
No, I don't know. I mean, the Sefer Chassidim already talks about Kolisha. It can't be usher to learn Torah with women singing, because he tells you there are women singing at every street corner. What can we do? You can't do that, right? If you live in a mixed Jewish, non-Jewish environment, and the non-Jewish women, are all singing O Soli Mia on the corners, you're not going to be able to ban Kolisha. That's all you can do. You can't. No, you can wear earmuffs, but that's kind of dangerous if you can't hear the cars honking. There was a story.
Just because it hasn't been done doesn't mean it cannot be done.
So what's the Torah Malachi Asharis? There was a Rosh Hashiva in Tervadas, supposedly, who walked with a limp because his practice always was to walk with one foot on the curb and one foot down, so he wouldn't actually have to look at anybody else while he was walking. So there'd be no one else in his line of sight, and that way he avoided looking at improperly dressed women. But most people aren't going to be willing to go like this their whole life. That's Lonit Torah Malachi Asharis. You want to claim Yehoreg Vel Yavor, so certainly it's worth a win? Maybe. You also ask, the story's a little funny, because when he walked back the other way, wouldn't Dave even doubt? I don't know. Maybe it's a one-way street. I don't know. I don't know. Can't vouch for the authenticity of the story. All right. That brings us to the other Tosfos. Okay. So, Jared, how did you understand the second Tosfos in Shabbos? What's his answer?
That it was made. For, I mean, we had a little bit of a discussion about this.
Yeah.
But Deshavia. but it was made for Avodah Geulim versus Illinois.
Uh-huh.
But otherwise, the same, I mean, Machim B'Nash HaKadosh, using it, I guess, the same way as it was used above.
So he has two categories, right? One is things made for Avodah Zarah, and the other is things made for Noy. So which way is it exclusion? Is it things made for Noy or Mutter and everything else is Usser, or things made for Avodah Zarah is Usser and everything else is Mutter?
I'm not sure, because it sounds like the Usser one, I mean, anything, the duty that it's referring to are things that are made for Avodah Geulim. Right?
Yep.
But everything else is considered the Noy.
So you think that the two categories are Avodah Zarah and everything else?
Yeah, I guess.
Okay, all right, so the reasonable position of Tosef, so I would say that what Tosef does is, he turns the Isser of Al-Tiftu El-Halilim into a straight Avodah Zarah Isser, and it only applies to Avodah Zarah, to Avodah Zarah images, and it's so, right, so you have, this is the radical opposite of my original interpretation of Rashi. Right, so that there is no, really there's no, we don't care about the visual at all. Right, to show you how we don't care about limiting it to the visual. Right, so Rabbi Yerucham, just puts it into the same category as Lishmo Kleshir. Right, the prohibition against listening to Avodah Zarah music, there's a prohibition against looking at Avodah Zarah art. That's fine, but everything else, right? But if it's Linoi, what would the problem be? Okay, now the interesting question we have is So what is kadosh about the binan shel kadoshim in this case? If halachic, right, we make a halachic claim that al tifnu alelim is solely about things that are made l'shem avodah zarah. So, and there's no issur at all about looking at art. So why is there a supererogatory claim, right? Why is it chassidut to not look at coins? Yes, Didier.
Assuming that the Tosfot in Shabbos and the Tosfot in Avodah Zarah don't necessarily need to jive one with the other,
mm-hmm.
then you could make the claim that that according to at least Tosfot in Avodah Zarah, the coins were Avodah Zarah.
So one possibility is that financial kedoshim, it's not that they wouldn't look at things that were for Noi. If they wouldn't look at things that were for Avodah Zarah, even though they had not yet been Nevad.
Right, or even if there were things that everybody needs to use a lot.
Even if there were things that everybody needs to use a lot, right? So I think you could read Tosfot as establishing a claim that looking at images per se is an unholy, although mutter action, right? In which we say that the Tosfot's limitation to things of Avodah Zarah is only sort of a limitzchus, or a rationalization, because really the ambit of the Isser is all visual images. Or you can claim that no, you know, there's a one category which is things that images of Zeus that happens nobody has worshipped. And that we can see, you know what, looking at images of Zeus, because the odds are that nobody has worshipped them, that's still not such a good thing to do if you can avoid it.
Can you give reference to the first figure that we did?
In what sense?
Possibly not use them. So
Ben
Shalkadoshim didn't even look at them.
So we could also claim, right, could claim that in fact there's a totally separate Isser, which has nothing to do with Al-Tifnu, and the Kedusha of Ben Shalkadoshim is unrelated to Al-Tifnu Al-Ilim. It's about a separate Isser of the Redisra Adam, Lotasuniti, right, which is what some of the Rishonim that we did in the Lotasuniti Sugya seem to believe, right, because they connected the Ben Shalkadoshim to that Isser. So that's also plausible. Tosfos doesn't mention it, but it's certainly a plausible read as well. All right, so I think you have three basic options in that regard, and you can decide for, you know, I would much rather not read the Tosfot expansively as saying that it's an aspect of kedusha to not look at any visual image. I'm comfortable with either of the other two. Okay. That brings us to the Rambam. Now the Rambam, right? The first thing, the Rambam in Hilchos Hilchos Shabbos tells you that Usher Likros B'Ksav Mahalach Tachas Atzura V'Tachas Dikni B'Shabbos. And what happens to the prohibition against looking at tzuros? Not there, which is perfectly reasonable, right? So we have in our Gemara, we have as an accidental phenomenon in which somebody, the Gemara is not, the rites are not organized conceptually, they're organized mnemonically. Right? So we say, you know what, you can't read the things under them on Shabbos. By the way, that reminds me, you can't even look at these during the week. Okay? But the Rambam, who you know gets the organized conceptually, so he puts the ksav, right, one thing in Shabbos, and he waits for the Isser to show up in Avodah Zarah. Right, so the Rambam Avodah Zarah Perek Bet Halacha Bet says, "Svarim Rabbim Chibru of the Kochav Mevadasa Heach Ikar Avodasa Umam Aseha Mishpateha." See that Kadosh Baruch Hu shall likros be'osan hasfarim klal, v'lo neharer ba, v'lo bedavar midvareha, v'afilu l'histachel bedmus hatzura asur, sh'ne'emar al tifnu el ha'lilim. Okay, so the Rambam radically transforms the Isser, whereas up till now we've been trying to figure out, well, you know what, it includes looking, maybe there are other things other than sight it might extend to. The Rambam thinks that sight is the least of the issues. But it's not that you're extending it from sight to reading. For the Rambam, sight is the extreme case. Really, the Isser is reading. Right, but by the way, in addition to reading, the Gemara goes on and says it's even usser to look at it. So that's a very radical claim. Right, that's a very radical claim. It's not a claim, I think it's fair to say, that it's not a claim which is sustainable on the basis of our Gemara as such, right? There's no evidence in our Gemara that we're talking about an extreme. There's no, the Rambam has no makor for a claim that Al-Kishnu Al-Elim extends to anything other than the visual. And in fact, to back up this claim, the Rambam has to quote several other psukim where he seems to be creatively generating isurim. It's a very nice interpretation of the psukim, but it's not really precedented. What the Rambam has going for him is that he makes sense, which is the problem we had with Rashi. Why would we limit this to the visual? Right. So to limit this to the visual, we tried to come up with with fancy stories about imagination and. That imagination is right, and concretization of imagination, all sorts of fun things like that. But if it's based on the Avodah Zarah, right, so then we would have to argue there's something unique about the visual that makes it susceptible to Avodah Zarah. But the Rambam says, no, there's nothing unique about the visual that makes it susceptible to Avodah Zarah. Given a choice, it's much more mutter to look at an Avodah Zarah statue than to read a book of mythology. So the Gemara just mentioned the statue. By the way, even the statue. Okay, so the chumrah of the Rambam is that whatever it's usher to be mistakel at a tzura of, it's usher to know anything about. It's usher to pay any attention to, right, intellectually. The kulach is that it's only an avodah zarah halacha. Right, so we can just right. So in terms of practicalities. We can apply all the stories we use to generally limit Avodah Zarah Yisurim, which is to claim it doesn't apply to Avodah Zarah that are gone. Yes, Emily?
This is just reinforcing what I really thought yesterday, which is that Al-Kishnu Al-Halilim is like this general kind of like religious outlook, and then everything else kind of falls into details under that. And I said it yesterday in the Sogya itself about like the law of not looking at the Diokin.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it here again, I think that's what the Rambam's saying, that it's a general thing, and it's so expansive that you can't look, and you can't read, and you can't do anything, because it falls under this, like, kind of telling you how to approach your life, that you can't go in the direction of Elohim.
Yeah, I think that's right. The Rambam says that, right, don't, stay away They are far away. Don't even think about it. Lo neharba. V'lo bedavar mid v'reha. Okay. So I think that, you know, so again, I think that has a chumrah. I think it has a kula. And it's not a, you know, it's not a difficult thing to justify an issue like that. You have to figure out, you know, whether you have any hesitancies about applying. You know, do we really wish people to not know anything about idolatrous religions? Maybe not. Oh, we can take the Ramban along that category also. The Makor I skipped are just because I thought you should be aware of the controversies about reading mail on Shabbos. They're fun, and we'll get back to them a little bit later, I hope. Okay. Now the Kesef Mishnah has a fascinating question. Rachel, what do you want to say?
Sorry, I was just going to mention because I know you skipped over being in Yerucham, but I just thought this was sort of important because usually it comes up when it's quoted multiple times later. But I thought this was interesting that it says Asur Lishma Klisher, okay, and then it also says Olahi Sakel. Kavan Shanae Nebaraiya,
yes.
And that it seems that is the reason, you could say that reason is obviously just a modification of Lahit Takel, but in reality there's no Kavan Shanae whatever from Lishmo Aklashir, and it's sort of troubling that it would only, that you can't say Ra'iya, seemingly you can't say Ra'iya would apply to both Shmia and
Lahit Takel. Uh-huh. I see, it should be Kavan Shanae. Interesting. I left out, which I should point out. He also said the reason is Hana, which seems to imply that it's mutter to look at these things as long as you don't enjoy it. Right. So yeah, which is because the Isser is Hana. That's a very interesting claim, right? You know, so intellectual interest per se, maybe not. It depends on how you define Hana, right? So he quotes a sugya which tells you that Mara is capable of generating an Isser, although not the Isser of Me'ila halachically. So right, so maybe we can talk about the, you know, definition at all. But I agree with you in the sense that he doesn't mention Shmia. I tend to think that he means both, but you can try and claim that by seeing it different than hearing if you wish. Okay. Kesef Mishnah asks this fascinating question, which is if the Rambam were right that Al Tifnu Al Elim means Al Tifnu Al Elim, so why would the Gemara have to ask my Talmud? Right. That's a vicious question, right? Wait, the Rambam is reading the words literally. So who needs a right? That he thinks that the phrase my mashmar, my Talmuda requires you to darshan the pasuk in a way which is not obvious in his reading. In other words, he thinks that the question of the Gemara can't be what's the pasuk. That would be my kra. Right, but my mashmar, my Talmudah, has to mean we can think of all the relevant psukim. How do you get the pasuk to mean this? Right, which because in fact, right, he's right because the Gemara says Al Tifnu Halalim, and the Gemara says my Talmudah. So if my Talmudah just means Al Tifnu Halalim, what's the thing? So the Kesef Mishnah has to come up with a claim that where he says nearly the mashmar le Al Tifnu Hainu Shelo Yifne Lelechet Bedarcheihem Below Lestor Lehistakel Beturasa Lachi Boy my mashmar. So the Kesef Mishnah has to come up with this very imaginative claim that the Rambam's might al tifnu al midatchem, Rambam learns that as a specific iser of histaklus. Somehow el midatchem gets you that specific iser. I have to say, this seems to be wholly unconvincing. Why does El Midat Chem teach me Histaklus as opposed to El Halilim? Right, either Tifnu El means looking or it doesn't mean looking. So I have to say that the Kesef Mishnah's answer is wholly unsatisfying to me, but his question is a great question. If the Rambam's right that El Tifnu El Halilim just means that, then why does the Gemara have to say, why does the Gemara need El Tifnu El Midat Chem? Right, what is El Midat Chem? What does El Midat Chem add to Elilim? So Rashi tells you, El Midat Chem means even things which are not idolatrous. Right? That's a real meaning. But according to the Rambam, right, what does that drasha mean? What does El Midat Chem mean? Okay, we'll see the answer later. All right, but for now, you should hold the question, because it's a great, great question. Okay, so right, then we have a whole set of sugyot discussing what Shtari Hedyotos are and what's usher about them to read on Shabbos. Again, we'll get back to that. That leads us to the Tosfos on Kuf Tes Zayin Amud Beis. The Tosfos on Daf Kuf Tes Zayin Amud Beis goes through the whole question. Everybody has this question. It's a fascinating thing. We can't do it in depth. It's always valuable to see the Balei Tosfos struggling with contemporary practice on the assumption that frum people don't do usher things. Right, so Balei Tosfos generally assume frum people don't do usher things, so if frum people do this, it must be mutter. And if it's against the Gemara, then we need to reread the Gemara. Let's find ways of balancing it. So we have all sorts of fun things, and how you read the Gemara requires you, among other things, to know what the minhag is, because you have to justify whatever the local minhag is, on the whole. But what we're interested in is the last line of Tosfos. And it says, "Mihu osan hamilchamo saksuvin bilaz nira l'Rabbein Yehuda de asur la'ayin behu behen de lo gara mehadetanya perksho tav shetachas asura v'yuknos asur l'kros behen b'shabbos da afilu b'chol lo yada ri mihitir de havale kemoshav leitzim." Okay, so now we have a category which seems to have been arisen sort of, it's in the same context as the Juke and Asbos Asr Lisakil Ba, but it introduces a new pasuk. A new pasuk, right, Moshav Leitzim. Right, so it's sort of fascinating the way this develops. The Gemara says you can't read it, and oh, by the way, you can't read the captions, and by the way, you can't look at the picture because Al Tufna Elilim. So in the midst of discussing other things you can't read, So that generates a pattern for people to say, oh, and by the way, this thing you can't read on Shabbos, right, guess what? Whoever allowed it during the week. That becomes a genre. So he bans Milchamos Haksuvin Bilaz because it's Moshav Leitzim.
During the week or on Shabbos?
During the week, right. During the week, Milchamos Haksuvos Bilaz are Asur Mishum Moshav Leitzim. So why are they Moshav Leitzim?
Because
it's Bittul Torah, so anything is Asur.
Yeah.
So why also Milchamos Haksuvin Bilaz, right?
It's an example,
and it really means all non-Torah activities are Asur.
Yeah, I mean, like, I guess eating.
Eating is mutter.
Yeah, sleeping up in a measured amount.
It's a little strange, right?
Because we're talking about Shabbos, and that afilu before, it's afterwards. The milchamot b'laz aren't written in the afilu b'chol part of the Torah. They're written in the Shabbos part.
That's right.
The b'chol refers to everything. And it's not even an example. It's saying this should fall into this other category that we know from elsewhere.
Yeah. So, do you agree with Yedidia that basically this is just claiming that all non-Torah activities are usher?
I think Yedidia is plausible.
Jonathan, what do you think?
What do I think he means, or do I think, what do I think is plausible?
What do you think he means?
I mean, when I learned this again for the first time, I never fully understood what the distinction, like, I never understood why you make the distinction between Laz and Lashon HaKodesh, which is at least how it's played up later on.
Later on, yes.
To assume that that's actually what he means, as opposed to, I assume that that Tosfos couldn't possibly have meant that, but there's a distinction that...
Why couldn't he have meant that?
I just didn't find it plausible. That
you don't find the distinction between Laz and Lashon HaKodesh plausible.
Right, meaning that Laz wasn't Dafka, was Lav Dafka. That's
uh-huh.
Just his example.
So why is reading about Milchamos Moshav Leitzim?
Presumably because there's no reason to read it. It's pointless.
Because it's pointless. Because it's pointless. Whereas every other activity in life is pointful.
Well, not every other activity, but
so
I mean, you could make a claim that anything which is pointless is more delayed to him.
Uh-huh.
Now, how much is limited to Milkamot, right, and how much is, right, I mean, whether you expand this to all, you know, whether you know, it means history, or it means Dafka, you know, just all the different, things like all the different wars of all the different kings in Europe, and you're just sort of, you know, reading about petty politics.
Uh-huh. So he doesn't like politics. He thinks politics is most of life, too.
I think that whether or not that's what he's saying, I think that would be a plausible argument. But
uh-huh. Al, what do you think?
I take it more literally and say the kind of people who read these things are unsavory people. You shouldn't associate yourself.
Aha. Uh-huh. Unsavory people read war stories.
And it's most of they seem literally.
Aha. Uh-huh. Puts you in the class. It's like, you know, you don't want to be the kind of person who reads Harlequin romances. You don't even want to be the person who knows about how the romances are.
People, you'll talk to them a lot if you
read it. Because you'll join book clubs. Didi, what did you want to say?
I was going to say, I think it's difficult to make the... It could be difficult to make the pointless argument. Just in and of itself. Because, you know, you say, okay, so this is, right, all the learning out there is pointless activities. So then, right, you say, okay, so what are activities... Right, that are, right, not, I guess, like, you know, Torah or mitzvah activities that are pointful. And you could say, you know, reading, let's say, great literature, because great literature has a point. And say, well, what's the, you know, and then you could say, well, and, you know, also playing games sometimes is a point because it increases our, you know, sort of spiritual freedom and makes us, you know, able to learn more Torah later or something like that. And also, something would have the point is like reading the Chumash.
Uh-huh.
And then, you know, and then Napoleon the Pig has put on a suit. Right, and right, the it's basically you just gone back on your whatever.
All right. Uh-huh. Okay. I sort of assume that people in fact read these on Shabbos, and so he's not making a conceptual point at all. He's saying you over there reading that book on Shabbos. No, stop! And by the way, it's not necessarily just because it's Shabbos. What are you doing wasting your time? And he's taking absolutely no position about softball. Right? I think this is not a conceptual position at all. He is taking a position about tennis. Right? They have mentioned that one of the earliest mentions of tennis we have is one of the Balei Tosfot writing a complaint about the people who go out into the courtyard during the sermon and play tennis. This was published by the Royal Historian of Wimbledon. But so we know that they're against tennis, but can't tell you anything about softball, which isn't played in the courtyard. Yes?
Is there any possibility that the Moshe Leitzin only applies to the youth note half of it, and not to the first half?
Where did you
Because half the tachat asura youth note.
Yeah, but it says, afil b'chol yodari mihitir, but we know, right, you don't have to ask the question mihitir, because it's, yivani should just say mishum al tifnu al alilim, right? We have a pasuk for that in the Gemara. There's a popular practice. I don't think there's a popular practice of people going around reading captions in public. And if there were, he wouldn't have to say mihi tirlem. I mean, it's just against the Gemara.
You think there are no people that read captions ever?
I don't think there's a big practice that people, you know, that are going. And if it were, right, if people going around reading captions, he wouldn't say any of them mihi tirlem da havelei al tifnu helalim. All right. That quoting Moshe Leitzin implies that he knows this is a new issur, I think. Okay. Now here's my question. Maybe.
I mean, especially viewing Al-Tifnu as Michal Al-Shabachem as like a similar field.
Maybe. I want to hold that for now. The question I want to ask is, suppose we have this Gemara, okay? But I tell you that I think that there are few things more pointful for Americans to do right now than to read the Peloponnesian War by Donald Kagan. Because the Peloponnesian War is the record of the war between Athens and Sparta. And the war between Athens and Sparta is a war, is the history of a war that was started by an imperial democracy. And how that imperial democracy eventually fell on hard times by overextending itself, And also, it's also important because it tells you how imperial democracy was so assured of its virtue that it engaged in horrific acts in the belief that democracies always behave more ethically than non-democracies. Also, it teaches you that democracies have a flaw, which is that if they start losing a war, the politicians can't admit that they have lost the war, and so democracies keep on pouring more and more resources into wars that they are losing. Democracies can never concede defeats. So I would tell you, I think that all of you, I think all of you, it's hard to imagine that there would be something more pointful for you to read in your time than The Peloponnesian War by Donald Kagan. I've only read the one volume edition, so I can't tell you anything about the five volume. Whether you need to read the five volume as opposed to the one volume.
Do you really think that?
Yes. I think if you have to pick a book, a book to read right now, The Peloponnesian War by Donald Kagan should be very high.
So how are we not at the end of Animal Farm now?
How are we not at the end of Animal Farm?
Right, where we've gotten back to the point where we were trying to get rid of at the beginning, right? We authored reading history because it's pointless, and that taught us that only pointful things are mutter, and now we're being mutter histories because
Now I want to ask you, what did we do lehalacha when you have a rishon who states this is usher because it is pointless?
He doesn't.
I would like Moshe Blitzin.
Do we know what Moshe Blitzin is?
Yeah, I think I'm pretty clear that Moshe Blitzin. You want to try and get out of it later, and claim it only means hanging out with people, with worthless people. I'm okay with that. For now, I'm going to take a very yeshivish thing. Moshe Blitzin is pointless. Okay. So granting that assumption, so what happens with halacha if a rishon says, I think that it is usher to read these books. No, actually, he says, I don't know why it would be mutter to read these books, to be more precise, because reading such books is pointless. And then somebody comes along and says, you know what? I agree 100% with Tosfot that one ought not to spend time reading pointless things. But I disagree very strongly with the claim that reading English books about past wars is pointless. Right. So what is the halachic strength of Tosfot's position that reading wars is pointless? Okay? Yes, Rachel.
Well, I feel like in terms of stuff, I don't like or admire or approve of reality television, and I could say it's completely pointless. But for me to impose an ether on other people who enjoy it, because of my judgment call, I could even myself make an argument for why I think it's a really worthwhile endeavor.
Uh-huh.
And even though I don't truly believe that, but to author it is, I think, a really radical next step to make, that you only do it when there's either more objective things at hand, which I don't think this seems to be a case of, or you do it because it has obvious detrimental effects. So here I feel like the actual halachic, status, the pull of this should be very strong, and I'm not sure Tosfot is intending it to be very strong as opposed to just be polemical.
Uh-huh. That's nice in Tosfot, but it's going to get harder because later people do take it as having straight halachic force. I agree with you that you might have a first move is to have a strong bias to read Tosfot and say Tosfot doesn't say it's usher, he just says any of damn me he's here. Well, guess what? Hi, I was just not here. All right, that's all the problem, right? Tosfot didn't know. Now we know. It took it took about 700, 800. Well, but
Why do it in Tosfot's time? Because I give a heter.
Assuming that I'm a Talmud Vatik. Right, a Talmud Vatik, right? So we know that everything I said was said at Sinai, so there. Maybe it's not a fair assumption. Yes, sure.
Why can't we say, maybe Tosfot is saying, that your reasoning for why this story should be mutar is because it has a point practically.
Mm-hmm.
So what if Tosfot would say, well, you're not allowed to think about that kind of thing on Shabbos? So the only reason you could read a war story is not the practical thoughts about war, because he would say that.
I thought it was during the week. Forget Shabbos.
Well, maybe.
Not during the week.
Maybe he's talking about Shabbos. Well, he said that
before. No, he doesn't feel, he's not talking about Shabbos. Right. What if we're standing right next to each other, okay? And there's the Ri, he's a great man. And the Ri says, Rabbi Clapper is terrible. I walked into the dorm and I saw all these yeshiva guys reading Donald Kagan's The Peloponnesian War. Who allowed that to them? And I say, well, you know a lot more pre-12th century Torah than I do. But I'm pretty good. I'm probably ahead on the post-12th century. Sorry, right? But, you know, this is really a great book. They should all read it. And even though, of course, I would never consider challenging your halakhic authority, when it comes to right what the Isra of Moshe Ableitim is, you get to define Isra Moshe, right? And I will not in any way attempt to defend the reading of pointless books. But this is a Messias question: is this book pointless or not? I think you read the wrong books. B, if you read this book and didn't get anything out of it, Mishulat Kvodcha. You should stick to reading halakha books because you don't know how to read history. Right? And obviously you guys get the analogy, right? That what happens if somebody bans looking at art because they believe that looking at art is pointless. But maybe that's just because they don't know how to read art. Yes, they do.
So I think there are two separate questions here, right? Uh-huh. One is, right, what things are pointless, right? When you ask what things are pointless, right, you can be asking two different questions, right? One, you can be asking, right, well, two people who disagree whether something is pointless or not could be disagreeing about two different things. They could be disagreeing about what valid points are,
mm-hmm.
right? Just to say, like, you think that, right, a valid point, right, that a value is being, right, educated about the political possibilities and well-being of your host country,
mm-hmm.
And the Ri does not. Right, and then you're disagreeing about what actual points are valuable.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing you could be disagreeing about is, if let's say you agree on what points are valuable, what actions will lead to those points?
He could be saying,
it's nice to be educated or whatever it is, but I just don't think that reading the Talmud gives you any.
Right.
So you can have a factual disagreement with him based on that, but if you're disagreeing about what points are valid, then you're having a normative disagreement with him.
That's right. So I would tell you that I find it inconceivable. Oh, sorry, I forgot to give you the video yesterday, Jonathan. I used to say, whenever Ravara Soloveitchik used to regularly in Shira's say, it's inconceivable my brother ever said anything like that. And people always muttering under their breath, I'm not sure that word means what you think it means. You haven't seen it either. That's one of the key lines is, right, inconceivable there could be someone following us, but there's a sale. It's inconceivable that he could be climbing. I'm not sure that word means what you think it means. So it's inconceivable that anyone could say that for a citizen of democracy to read a book which enables them to make far more informed decisions about issues of life and death for thousands and thousands of people is pointless. Can't be.
And the Ri might say, you keep using that word. I'm not sure if
you're using it. But the Ri also, it's like you live in a swing state.
It's the Ri here.
You can all lose.
No, most of
us
use the Ri.
No, it's going back.
Which of you
did?
Could be. I never trust attribution. Probably means I go bad, but I never trust attribution. So I don't know. It does, but. Sorry, yes. Who was in the middle? I could call in somebody. Emily, yes.
Could it be that when it says the things about the war, that it was just like a narrative of wars that happened?
Ah, so they have the move, right? We have the move. We say, of course he wasn't talking about Donald Kagan's and Peloponnesian War.
He was just talking about Thucydides.
He was just, well, see, that's hard. He couldn't have thought of Thucydides either. No.
Right.
And you should read Thucydides. You got to read Thucydides before you read Kagan, truthfully, although you don't know where he's coming from. I wasn't talking about Thucydides. Because if it was Thucydides, he would just say it's about Azara.
What's about Azara?
I'm not sure he talks about the gods in this. He doesn't know the gods at all?
Right.
He talks about Alcibiades and what Alcibiades' desecration of the gods and how that causes political. So there's certainly evidence there in that. I really love the Laharus. I know all that. yes, Adina, what do you want to say? Anyone? No. All right. So here, right, this is a core issue. What do we do with judgments that are post the halachic determination? But now we'd have one question: if what happens if a Baal HaTosfot makes what an obvious, verifiable, objective scientific error? Now we have the life and spontaneous generation question. Right, what happened? Right. So that's one kind of question. That's one kind of category. When a postic makes a claim based on the science of their times, which we now believe to be empirically an error. But what happens when a postic makes a statement based on the culture of their time? Or based on personal, right? Just based on...
We don't really know what it's based on.
That's right. So how much authority do we give it when he makes a claim that we disagree with and that I'm going to make a strong claim that we find it inconceivable that he would have disagreed with us if he heard if he got out of it what we did. Because how could he call it pointless?
I don't think that's inconceivable. Well,
okay, I think it's people who could do that and still earn my and still be worthy of respect.
Wait,
I'm okay. Maybe he's the kind of person who believes that that a political party should say, you know what, we don't care what our policy towards the Palestinians should be. The only issue that matters to us is whether these 10,000 shkolim go to our school system or somebody else's. Because after all, the relationship with the Palestinians just involves the future of the entire nation and the lives of our soldiers and stuff like that. But this is Talmud Torah. Maybe he thought that. Sorry, I'm a little bitter about that one. There was a time when the Knesset was deadlocked over whether proceed with left or right, whether proceed with the negotiations of the Palestinians under some circumstances or not. And the balance of power was held by a religious party. A religious party said, you know what, we'll go with them, we'll go with them. It doesn't matter to us as long as you give us more money for the yeshivas. And maybe that was brilliant, or maybe it was an unbelievable coalition. I tend to vote for the latter. Gotta care about life.
Is it inconceivable that there would be anybody whom you'd respect who would make that decision?
It's hard to, I hate to say, there's a rationalization. You might argue that, you know what, actually none of these governments will do anything anyway because the coalition is too narrow and we can always back out, right? When it comes to a big vote, we'll all back out anyway. Maybe they were thinking that way. But it was hard. It was hard to deal with. It was hard to deal with.
Doesn't think that you should read books to get your political beliefs.
But they didn't live in a democracy.
That's true. So I could argue. I can make distinctions. I could argue that he thought this because, in fact, it was silly for Jews to read these things because it had no impact, because Jews never got to make political decisions anyway. So I can make it socially dependent. Right? That's a strategy. Might even believe it. Right? He didn't get anything out of it. Now, the problem is that, what happens if I find the same person saying, and yes, and every time I go negotiate with the Gentiles, I reread Parshas Vayishlach. Right? Because Yaakov and Esav, that's my paradigm for dealing with war. And I have no interest whatsoever about reading any history of past negotiations. So that's not relevant. All I need is Yaakov and Esav and Vayishlach. I'd have a harder time saying that. Maybe. Okay, I want to read one more thing, which is we're going to skip the rush for now. All this, right, as you'll see by now, right, so the relevance of the category of what things it's mutter and asr to read on Shabbos is that people will, both ways will define things that are mutter to read on Shabbos or asr to read on Shabbos as things that have any purpose. Right, both ways, some people think that things that have a purpose are asr, some people think that things that have a purpose are mutter, but almost everybody defines the category of shtorei hadyotos in terms of what is useful and what is not. So, right, so we can then play that back into Moshe Vleitzin. Which things that people think are not Moshe Vleitzin, but are purposeful. Okay, but I'm interested right now in the Rush. So the Rush, after the whole long discussion, the Rush then goes on to quote Rabbeinu Yonah. And Rabbeinu Yonah, after his discussion of Shabbos, goes on to say, V'halan dichtivin melitzos v'meshalem shel sichas chulin v'divrei cheshek. Aster l'krosan b'shabbos. V'afilu b'chol l'yadana mehitiro sh'arei nemar v'moshav leitzim loteshiv akandir v'rinayon. So I want to contend, what you learned from here is this was a form, right? This was a form, and you stuck in to the form whatever it was you didn't like.
Form.
It was a form, right? If you were a Rishon, if you're writing a commentary, right? You have the model of Af
B'chol.
Oh, it's not like you have it today. Like this.
It's not like something you would put in an envelope.
No, not that you put in an envelope. No, but right, but it's a drush form, right? When you're reading this sugya, it's an opportunity to mention your bete noir, right? The thing you really don't like that people do. So nowadays, right, we would say the people who text, right, or the people who watch.
Like this in Ravadia.
Okay. Yeah.
Where he's like, right, he's talking about Maisa Shabbos, and they're trying to figure out whether TV shows that are made on Shabbos is Maisa Shabbos, and then the Alka Yosef is four pages.
I feel the cold.
Yeah,
Ravadia has two very long tshuvot banning TV. So what you discover is that Tosfot thought he was dealing with the plague of people reading Sifrei Milchamot HaKtuvim B'Lav, and Rabbeinu Yonah thought he was dealing with the plague of people reading Melitzot HaMishalim Shel Sichat Chulin V'Divrei Cheshek. Rabbeinu Yonah lived in Slobodka, I guess. Where romance novels were the problem. 19th century yeshiva generally, romance novels are the competition. That's why you get the Marcus Lehman novels. I love mentioning it. None of you ever read the Marcus Lehman novels? Marcus Lehman was a German who, in the time when romance, because we had the romantic movement, right? People read romance novels and they thought they were really meaningful. And so you have all these stories of yeshiva guys, romance novels between, you know, under the Gemaras and things like that. And so the only way to compete was to write from romance novels. So Marcus Lehman wrote from romance novels, which involves things like, you know, there's a Tel Yeshiva Bachar who's taken as a tutor to the princess. Right? And, you know, and his long... Right? And the prince, right? And, you know, he's tutoring the princess, and... Yichud, they're not so good at Yichud in these novels. They're very good at Nigiyah. Not so good at Yichud. And of course, over time, she comes to realize the truth of his religion, and she wishes to elope to learn Torah with him. And they sneak out at night, you know, the lower bed sheets, and they climb out the palace window, and they run away to sea, but they're captured by pirates. And at long last, they're separated. At long last, they reunite. Only discover that they're brother and sister. they're really. Meanwhile, of course, she's fallen in love with the handsome ex-smuggler. No, they're wonderful. They're wonderful fun, and they're mostly historical things based on typos,
they're
which are really
not Moshe
Blaisi. No, there's the Count of Kusi. Which is built on the Sar Mikutsi. So the Sar Mikutsi is a wonderful novel of the Shach, which is also apparently based on some kind of typo. Somewhere with you.
Is it the Shach or
no? No, it's a novel of Marcus Lehman, a novel about the Shach.
Oh, okay.
It's quite touching. So it was neat for Kabbalah. So Rabbeinu Yonah was dealing with that kind of issue. And that's what we have, that's why, you know, says Misora Publishing, right? CIS, right? If they have a whole genre of from adventure novels now, right? That's why people have to invent the Gemara Cup. Remember the Adventures of Gemara Cup? Gemara Cup is Encyclopedia Brown, right? For people, right? There's a short story of an adventure about kids. And the question is, what had finally happened? And he remembers, oh, there's a sugya and such which addresses this question. and he solves the mystery, right? Then you had to have, you needed a girl also, right? So the Devora Deresh, who didn't know any sugyas at all. So it was clever. No, I don't think they have. And, you know, there's a book out now about the influences of the adventures of Ktantan on American Judaism.
Cool.
Yeah.
He's Tom.
Yes, Tom Tom, right? All these Judaizations. So you have that now, right? You have They have a whole, you know, you have a whole set of yeshivish novels.
Tantan was already
yeshivish. Tantan was not. Tantan was already is an early American Judaism, but Gemara Kup was. And there are, you know, I don't read most of the yeshivish. There was a really good yeshivish novel published by some Neri Yisrael guys about 30 years ago, which I think deserves broader circulation, which is really quite, it's really quite good. About a Rebbe, a really fiery Rebbe who comes to a high school and inspires all the students, but people are a little nervous because he's a little too mustery and he gets them a little too fired up and too alienated from their society. It's really quite serious. I can't remember the name. I can't remember the author. I found it one day browsing in the YU library. And I know it's Neri Yisrael because the publication was 400 Mount place was 400 Mount Wilson Lane, Baltimore, Maryland, which is the Neri Yisrael dorms, I think. Okay. So this is right. So what I want to claim is that what you see is that there is this genre of halachic writing where people have this category of moshav leitzim. They have a form, right, which lets you say this thing which I believe is pointless should be usur. But they have no halachic basis for declaring this to be pointless. Right, they have a halachic category of pointlessness, moshav leitzim, which they then put in whatever activity is going on in their time, and they find pointless in. Now, it could be that they just objected to... Pardon?
Eating fruit.
Could be eating fruit, right? It could be that they knew exactly what we got out of it, and they thought that was pointless. It could be they just didn't get it. It could be that they opposed these things when they became competitive with Torah. Right, I didn't think that Moshav Leitzim are people who believe that other things are as important or more important than Torah. And they would have been fine with a little, you know, they would have been fine with somebody going to take a history class in university, but what they weren't okay is people spending Shabbos afternoon, right, just reading history books. That struck them as a violation. But we have to figure out what halachic force you give to their judgments about what is pointful. And then recognize that, of course, that will play out in all areas, because how you interpret the halacha will be dependent on whether you see something as valuable or not. So as a contrast to that...
I was just wondering if this question is at all impacted by the fact that we may recognize it as one.
So I'm suggesting that recognizing it as a form gives us more of an out to see it as non-halachic. But, you know, recognize this is sort of a form of, this is an occasion for Rishonim to vent, so to speak.
Right.
Well, we'll have to see how Achronim use the Rishonim. Right, but I'm suggesting is that when you see the Rabbeinu Yonah and Rabbeinu Yehuda, let's say, are using the exact same form, it tells you that that's what they're doing. They're not making conceptual claims. I don't think I would make a diuk that Rabbeinu Yonah thought milchamot shalaz were pointful. If I were having fun, I could claim that. Oh, look, see, there's a machloket. Because Rabbeinu Yehuda thinks that milito to mishalom shal sicha is cool and divrei cheshek. They're really cool. He just doesn't like milchamot shalaz.
They're both using them as examples.
Yeah, but if you claim that one of them had the other one's example, if Rabbeinu Yonah left out milchamot, why did he leave it out? Because he didn't think, right? I could do that. I don't want to make that claim right now. I think that would be cheating. Okay, the contrast I wanted to give you was the Ritva. So the Ritva dealing with Mutter on Shabbos. So the Ritva, right, so whereas other people are starting to say, what are people doing reading these things? So people have to try and cover the claim, oh, you have to read the mail because maybe there's a pikuach nefesh. Maybe there's a dvar mitzvah. I don't know.
For answering the phone.
Yeah.
But you have to answer the phone.
Well, you never know, right? This phone call might be Pikuach Nefesh. Right? At least if they have to for screening your calls on the answering machine. So you can listen to the messages, right? There, you guys got that.
Yeah.
So people are trying all these attempts to explain why people are, right, you know, because there's gotta be something of a great moment. Then you see these moments where they sort of, you know, where you kinda get the wink, you know, and say, you know, where maybe there's something of Pikuach Nefesh in there. You know, how many of us get mail? That's Pikuach Nefesh on Shabbos. Without somebody saying, this is a Pikuach Nefesh letter. It's just a plain brown envelope. Right? Yes, you do.
Well, first of all, there are those letters that say urgent.
I know those are clearly the important ones.
Good story. There's a guy in my community, a firm guy who used to run the budget under Clinton.
Mm-hmm.
And once on Shabbat, he got a phone call. And on the answering machine, it was, Jack, this is President Clinton. There's a problem with the budget. I really kind of need to talk to you. I know you don't answer the phone on Saturday, but I feel like God might forgive you this time. If you can give me a call back, please. thank you. So he asked the rabbi. The rabbi said, I think it's plausible. There could be some...
And I said, it's wrong. Right? The real story is Rahm Emanuel.
What?
Rahm Emanuel asked the Shaila to Rabbi LePatin.
Oh, really? Well, in this story, it's Jack Lew asked the Shaila to Avi White.
It could be. It wouldn't be quite... I guess there could be such a story, but it's certainly the case, because Rabbi LePatin has written about this.
It's almost certain that it happened to both of them.
Could be.
Right.
Could be. Well, it's funnier than messing with the answer machine. Rahm Emanuel asked the question.
Rahm Emanuel has a better claim, because he's chief of staff, where Jack Lew just...
Right. He was chief of staff, and he asked the question on Rosh Hashanah. Right, about whether he could make... During the battle about passing the first budget, I think. So he asked Rabbi LePatin if he could answer or make cell phone calls to get it through. And Rabbi LePatin said yes. And he has a whole post about this. I mean, talk about it in YU Smich also. People told me, you told me last, yeah? Somebody told me that last year he talked about it when he came into YU Smicha. I'll come home soon.
Definitely need you to come home.
Okay. 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 So, but what I want to point out here is that the Ritva has a new category in which she says, you know what? All the Pikuach Nefesh stuff, maybe. Maybe not. All the technical Eterim, maybe, maybe not. The Ode, Sh'im lo yikra'im yehei do'ei kol ha-Shabbat kula. People who don't read their mail on Shabbos go nuts. What's in the mail? Now, mail probably meant something different culturally.
Wait,
for
them. Does that mean
So now this is a pretty wild. It's a pretty wild essay.
You could have opened your Harry Potter book.
This is a friend.
You could have opened your Harry Potter book from the Amazon box, because it was extremely, extremely maddening.
I never actually got a Harry Potter book from Amazon, so I wouldn't know.
I know.
I got Harry Potter a second day from friends, so I knew I wasn't going to read it the first day. But
yeah, and if you did open it on Shabbos, then it's everyone else isn't reading it, and you're reading it.
Everyone's waiting for you to borrow it. If you don't open it on Shabbos, then you can't lend it to your friend on Sunday.
No, because it's the one guy who had the open copy who's reading it on Shabbos, and everyone else is upset because they have the closed copy and the other...
Well, everyone else, if it's much of you, it's much of everyone else too, Lechora.
Oh, we all have open copies.
So, whether one wishes to... Whether one wishes to paskin like this Ritva or not is a fair issue, but... What I'm interested in is that the Ritva all of a sudden puts in a counter issue, which is that when it comes to figuring out what's mutter on Shabbos, we have to think about what people care about. And he doesn't address the question of whether people ought to be worried kol Shabbos kula. He could have just told them, tough. Why are you thinking about mail on Shabbos? You should be thinking about Sichas Chulin and Divrei Cheshek, or Milchama Shel Gayim, or Torah, whatever it is you think is valuable. So the Ritva seems to present a counterpoint, which says that Halacha takes into account what other people find valuable, not just what the Posek thinks they ought to find valuable. Because of course the Posek is going to say, no, it's silly to spend your whole Shabbos worrying about this.
That's a different question of values. I mean, the two things don't have to contradict each other.
That's right. They don't have to contradict each other. I think that it says, but they're in tension with each other. Right? One is the clear imposition of the POSIG's decision about value on the population.
If you try to abstract them, then yes. But if you don't try to abstract them,
that's right. That's why I say they're in tension. Because if you try to abstract them, bad things happen. You can contain them, and then they won't contradict each other. But if you abstract them, then you discover that they have tendencies to expand into each other's domains. Right? Because one is a genre. One is a model in which Poskim impose their value judgments on everybody else. You there, reading that book, that's Usser, even no matter what you tell me, even if you tell me that reading that book is the best thing for your soul right now. And the other is saying, since there are some people who think this would enhance their Shabbos, who might Usser it?
We assume that the Ritva is not simply building a Chada.
He needs another Heter if it's really Pikuach Nefesh?
No, he's saying it doesn't. He's saying it might legitimately be Pikuach Nefesh, and that it may not be Ole to the level of Pikuach Nefesh, or the possibility that someone might get in the mail something Pikuach Nefesh might not qualify.
Right.
The fact that helps people view their mail, right?
Yeah, so tell them not to.
Except that may have been plausible. Right? I mean, the fact that...
If it's plausible, that is mutter. Who needs it? Either it's really Pikuach Nefesh or it's not. You're telling me people regard it as if it's Pikuach Nefesh because they take into account? Why is that different than people in a postik saying you can eat that because it's batel? And somebody says, I don't care. I'm worried I'm eating treif. You say, no, it's mutter. So tell them it's mutter. What are people being mechush? If we start letting people decide on their own boundaries for Pikuach Nefesh, they'll go be mechal Shabbos left and right. Right? I need to refuel my car today. Because I'm afraid if I don't refuel my car, that tomorrow my next door neighbor is on Shabbos. Tomorrow my next door neighbor is going to show up or answer the phone.
Right. These are things which are actually usher.
And this is usher or not, depending on whether I choose to give them credence, isn't right?
Right.
So
I'm not sure he's not simply saying, look, the psychological reality is that people are worried about it. So it's not right. It's not a frivolous activity, right?
Do you think he's worried only about Pikuach Nefesh? Or is it just...
What are they worrying about? Do'eg does not mean you're going to drive them nuts. It means they are worried.
What about they're worried? They're worried that a relative has died somewhere else. They're worried that their business is tanked.
They're worried that they won that lottery.
Do we know the realities of what mail is like?
Well, mail wasn't delivered regularly, I don't think.
Right,
so I think
like you would have gotten a letter and...
It's more like a telegram. Although we know they had a Geret Shlomim, right? We know people just sent invitations also, right? If we get that, and people sent receipts. Right? So I'd say it's probably fairer to say that it's more like getting a telegram in the early 1900s. And it cost money to send a letter. So it probably was something important. But Pikuach Nefesh, it can't be a real case of Pikuach Nefesh. You could claim if you want that it's really just a continuation of the previous line. Even though it's not really Pikuach Nefesh, people will worry it's Pikuach Nefesh. But I think it's more plausible to say that when people get important letters, it drives them nuts not to know what's in it. If you get a package, you don't know who it's from.
He doesn't say drives them nuts. He says to wait.
Uh-huh.
Wait means you're worried about something. I'm not sure, and I'm not. I don't think you can prove that it's not. That he's not just saying. Look, he's saying. Look, maybe it's Pikuach Nefesh. It's probably not, but it could be. Right?
I can't prove it. I don't think the word doeg needs to carry that. I think doeg can mean just to be. Pardon?
He also says odu, which seems to set it apart.
No,
it
doesn't have to be a separate answer. It could be the second half.
Right. We have to look at all the other places that the way he shows up in real ones, but it seems plausible to me that the way means does not just mean you're afraid of Pikuach Nefesh. Says Jastro, to be low spirited, to sorrow or fear.
It doesn't help us what it means. Right. The only thing that matters is what the ritual uses it as.
Yeah, but I don't think he means worry in that concrete a sense. It also has, you know, as an earlier line previously, which he thinks that kitvei shlomot are things that are necessary. Right, things are necessary. Things are necessary in Shabbos, so they're also mutter. I think the Ritva is more open. Can't prove it. I think he's more open. But I want you really to all be thinking about it as you read around it. The question of to what extent do post-textual value judgments have halachic force? Right, if a posik tells you, if a posik says the text means this, meaning the text creates this category, and I place action or object X into Y category. And you, what authority does it have if you have an independent judgment as to that? And your independent judgment is not based on, I disagree with your hashkafa. It's based, although it could be that also, but it may be based on, I disagree with your understanding of what happens in this work. Like what happens if a, what happens if...
This is in that model as well, though.
Yeah?
I mean, the Rishma chooses to say that his Kol Shabbat Kolah is viewing his Yoi Kol Shabbat Kolah as a relevant halakhic entity.
That's right.
He doesn't say you can decide what's Mutter, he's saying this particular thing.
That's right, because I don't want to claim that Poskim can't make judgments. Of course they can make judgments. Right? That's, I don't... It's, you know, I would treat it as reductio ad absurdum to say that Poskim can only state what the text mean and can never Poskim. Right? There has to be, right, a Poskim has to be able to say that this fits, right? You have to be able to say that pork is usur and this is pork. Right? But there may be an intermediate category where, right, in most of those cases, right, where you have access to much more, to other categories where the Posik is making a judgment about something which is subjective, or places where you have expertise, the Posik doesn't. I'm not sure. And again, there are strategies. It might be that you might say, you know, I never want to take on a Posik like that, but if a Posik seems to be making a statement that is absolute, which it seems to me is implausible as an absolute, I will, to be generous to the Posik, I will read the Posik as making a statement that applies only to their reality. So I will assume that he read, right, that the author of this book, the author, right, the Reini Yehuda, say, read the Sipurei Milchamot he read, right? I don't know what his library was, but I'll assume that whatever books it is he read were books that in fact were simply glorifications of great military deeds without any insight into strategy and causes. Right, in that way, I will be comfortable saying that even Rabbi Yehuda would be perfectly happy with you reading the Peloponnesian War and probably Thucydides.
Or that there was just little to no need in communities of...
Right, or I will claim, right, that he was dealing... I was claiming that he was dealing in his reality in the same way that I might... That in the same way that in a society with arranged marriages, a Posig might very well say that books about dating are Moshe Avleitzim. Because they are, but the same book which is Moshe Avleitzim in an arranged marriage society is not Moshe Avleitzim in a dating society because you have to know how to do it. Right? So I can make that claim perfectly happily also that there are things that were Moshe Avleitzim in a totalitarian society that are not Moshe Avleitzim in a democratic society. I'm open to making moves like that. The question of which, if any, of these moves are available to us to discuss with art is fair. Right, can we say that Rachel was trying to argue before that any restrictions on art in the post-game are only because they had no exposure to Jewish art, which again I think is a Rav Ariel type argument. I don't think it's engaging. It's discussing without precedent, or a Rav Ariel type argument. They were doing it because they lived in a society in which art was unnecessary, but in a complete society, art is necessary. Right, all those are fair moves. It's much more radical to claim that the reason that the Poskim banned art is because they never had the experience of standing, or they never had the experience of standing in front of a painting and have it grabbed them in the solar plexus. Right, that's a more radical claim. But it's also possible to make that claim, that they Poskim that way because they just didn't have that experience. They never had the opportunity. And had they had that opportunity, they would have Poskim differently. All right, we will break it at this point. Thank you, as always, for your attention.